Can knee pain be treated over the internet?
Maintaining weight loss?
Does timing of therapies for Parkinson's help?
And does ultrasound help bone healing?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on February 24th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think this one about treating knee pain, I said, over the internet, was really provocative. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
This is a really important issue because as we get older, about half Americans are going to have some osteoarthritis of the knee. And the typical ways we have of treating it have some side effects. For example, some of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications can be beneficial, but taken over a long term, they risk causing kidney damage or bleeding. So the question is, can we use non-pharmacologic techniques that are beneficial, have little side effects, relatively inexpensive, can be administered virtually anywhere? And that's exactly what this study addressed. It looked at 148 individuals over the age of 50 that had chronic knee pain and did an intervention via the internet. It included educational material, 7 video conferences with physiotherapists to help them with home exercise, and they also had a program to manage the pain coping skills training. They administered the therapy over 3 months and then came back and asked how were they doing in 9 months. They compared this to just providing educational materials. The nice thing is the vast majority of people completed the program, they adhered to it, they were satisfied with it, and there was a significant improvement in knee pain and in physical function, not only at 3 months, but even sustained out to 9 months.
Seems to me like the good news is that if it's something that's available on the internet, we can certainly readminister very easily.
Absolutely. The value of doing that is you can do it on your time. You don't have to go anywhere. This is really helpful for people who live in rural areas. So I think this is a really terrific study.
Outstanding. Since we're in Annals, why don't we turn to another really timely issue that affects lots of folks. If you've lost weight and you want to maintain that weight loss, devoutly to be wished, I would add, how can we do that?
This is really important because weight loss and maintenance of that are two different aspects. Weight loss, the initiation of that, requires changes oftentimes in physical activity and in nutrition training, whereas maintenance therapy could be very different. And it's known that what is applicable or helpful for initiation of weight loss isn't necessarily helpful for maintenance of that. These investigators tried to establish the effectiveness of a weight loss maintenance program that was administered primarily over the phone compared to usual care in obese adults. Now, these were individuals that were seen at 3 primary care clinics in the VA system that had all lost at least 4 kilograms, that's about 10 pounds, during a 16-week group-based weight loss program. And then they enrolled them in maintenance intervention, delivered primarily via telephone. And they addressed the satisfaction with the outcomes, relapse prevention planning, self-monitoring, social support, all those things wrapped up in this versus what's called usual care. That is, there was no contact except to continue to monitor their weight. After 56 weeks or almost a year, the primary outcome was, did they regain the weight? So those in the usual care regained approximately 2.4 kilograms. That is, regained about 6 or 7 pounds. Those in this particular maintenance intervention conducted over the telephone gained about a pound or a pound and a half. So this shows that an intervention that's based primarily on maintenance-specific strategies can help slow the rate of weight regain in obese individuals, but in honesty, it's fairly modest.
It's still better than nothing, though, I would say, Rick. And also, this is something we really need to get our arms around, because while some of our management strategies or treatments for morbid obesity, for example, gastric bypass, even those folks, a large percentage of those folks, regain significant weight. So I really think we got to figure this out, whatever it is.
I agree. It's unfortunate that we can't maintain the weight loss. On average, the average American gains somewhere between 1 to 2 kilograms per year from the age of about 50 on. So the fact that this slows that down is somewhat helpful, but it tells me that we still have more work to do.
Finally, I think the last thing I would add about this obesity issue is that I frankly am starting to believe that there's something physiologic that's different in people who have had a profound weight gain, and that even when they lose the weight, there's still something different about their physiology that persists and stymies them in these kind of maintenance efforts.
You're right. And we've addressed this in previous podcasts as well. It's interesting that much of the regaining weight occurs fairly early on after the weight loss. So I agree with you. It's physiologic as well.
More on that, unquestionably. Let's turn from here to JAMA Neurology. I'm really fascinated with this, an admittedly very small study, but a look at whether accommodating circadian rhythms in the use of drugs and other things for managing Parkinson's is helpful.
Parkinson's disease is the second most common neurodegenerative disorder affecting more than 1 million people in the United States. And I'm not sure that many of our listeners are aware that sleep abnormalities affect 90% of these individuals. Now, this is either having problem sleeping, that is sleep fragmentation, or excessive daytime somnolence. Oftentimes, this is attributed to either the medications or the advancement of the disease. What we know is that many of our sleep habits are part of what's called our chronobiology, or the circadian rhythms. And we know that how we work, whether that's during the day or night, and our exposure to light affects that substantially. So what these authors did was they tried to integrate that and ask a simple question. If we administer light therapy to people with Parkinson's disease, an hour, twice daily, can that improve their sleep disorder? And secondly, does it in any way affect their Parkinson's disease, the severity of their disease? So as you mentioned, it was a fairly small study. It was 31 patients, but they exposed them to either bright light, 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the late afternoon, or to dim red light, that was a control. And then they assessed their sleep activities and, again, the severity of their disease. And what they discovered was, in fact, the exposure to bright light did improve their daytime somnolence. They were less likely to be sleepy. It improved their sleep habits, and it also improved the severity of their Parkinson's disease as well. And this was just 2 weeks of therapy. So this is, again, really nice. There are no side effects. It's easy to administer. It can be done at home. It's inexpensive, and it addresses an important issue in people that have Parkinson's disease.
I find it really fascinating. That was, of course, why I picked it. I'm also wondering about the relationship between light exposure. We know about light exposure and depression, especially seasonal affective disorder. And we also know that there's a lot of depression in Parkinson's disease. So I'm really very interested in these correlations.
And this is too short a time period, I think, to address that, but I think that's a really important issue. We know that the chronobiology and exposure to light and the sleep affects many hormones, melatonin being one of them, and other hormones or chemicals that are important in either causing or preventing depression. So I'd like to see a longer study. I'd also like to see this therapy optimized. What's the best type of light? What's the best timing of exposure? And will the effects last for a long period of time? So a lot more to be done. This is a pretty exciting study, though.
It sure is, and hopefully it can be employed really early in the course of the disease. Finally, then, let's turn to the British Medical Journal. Ultrasound, gosh, there were so many hopes for ultrasound in a therapeutic capacity. In this case, does low-pulse ultrasound really improve bone healing?
The scientific term is low-intensity pulsed ultrasound, otherwise known as bone stimulators. And they've been promulgated as a way of actually accelerating the healing of someone that has a fracture. The results have been somewhat mixed, though. And so what these authors attempted to do was to look at all the randomized controlled trials looking at low-intensity pulse ultrasound to see whether, in fact, they did advance healing of fractures. So these two independent reviewers were able to identify 26 randomized controlled trials with as few as 8 to as many as 501 individuals. And they asked the simple question, did they advance healing of a fracture of the tibia in the leg or the clavicle, the collarbone? And what they discovered was, compared to control, it looked like the ultrasound did not improve healing. You say, how did they assess that? Well, it didn't reduce the time to work. It didn't change the number of subsequent operations that were needed. It didn't change the pain, either the days or the intensity of it. It didn't change the amount of time it took the individual to become weight-bearing if they had a leg fracture, and there was no effects on the radiographic healing as well. Now, these are on the best studies. There were some small studies that really weren't very good. They call them high-bias studies. Those were the ones that suggest there may be a slight benefit, but actually the high-quality studies show no benefit with ultrasound with respect to healing of bone fractures.
It never made much sense to me from a biological perspective to begin with. So I'm, I guess, in some respects, not really surprised that this is the outcome. And of course, those kinds of things where we get to give it a miss are always things that I like.
Yep. It's nice to actually get the data and look at it. This is one of those therapies that in the United States, we spend about $250 million a year on this. And so if it's not helpful, then we can direct that money and activities to things that may be helpful.
I think on the blog this week, I'm going to talk about the circadian rhythms and timing of therapies for people with Parkinson's disease. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.